The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Former United States Poet Laureate Rita Dove won the 1987 Pulitzer Prize for Thomas and Beulah, a collection of verse that examined the lives of her grandparents. In addition to her many other collections, she's the author of an essay collection, stage play, a novel, and short story collection, and she has taught poetry at the University of Virginia for more than 30 years. She received the National Humanities Medal from President Clinton and the National Medal of Arts from President Obama, the only poet ever to receive both. At her commendation, President Obama said, "Through works that blend beauty, lyricism, critique, and politics, Miss Dove has illuminated American poetry and literature. And now she brings us Playlist for the Apocalypse, her first volume of new poems in 12 years. On this very special evening, she will be joined in conversation with Tripita Mason, Philadelphia's own poet laureate. Thank you all so much for being here. And now the screen is all yours."
Thank you. Thank you, Laura, very much. Oh boy, what an absolute pleasure to be here this evening with you, Rita Dove. And everyone, I am addressing our amazing, wonderful legend poet, Rita Dove, as Rita, because she gave me permission to do so. And I'm very honored to be in your presence, even if it's virtual. And I'm really, really happy to see you. Thank you. Thank you for this wonderful book. So I know we're going to start with you reading some poems from the book. And then we're going to follow with a conversation sitting on our back porches. I love it. And we'll talk a little bit, and then we'll open up the questions for the audience to ask some questions. So we'll start with you sharing, Ms. Rita Dove.
All right. Well, thank you again. I would be remiss if I did not read this poem, which takes place in Philadelphia. There is a group of poems which deal with Black Lives Matter, with ghettos that extend all the way back to the 16th century when the first mention of the word ghetto appeared in some transcripts, in some documents in Venice. This one is spoken by a young victim of violence, Najee, 14, Philadelphia. A bench, a sofa, any place flat. Just let me down somewhere quiet, please. A strange lap, a patch of grass. What a fine cup of misery I've brought you, Mama, cracked and hissing with bees. Is that your hand? Good. I did good. I swear I didn't yank or glare. If I rest my cheek on the curb, let it drain. They say we bring it on ourselves, and trauma is what they feel when they rage up, flashing in their spit-shined cars, shouting, "Who do you think you are?" until everybody's hoarse. I'm better now. Pounding is nearly stopped. Next time, I promise I'll watch my step. I'll disappear before they can't unsee me. Better gone than one more drop in a sea of red. When my daughter was 3 or 4 years old, she used to walk around the house saying, "Nobody loves me but the spring cricket." And we could not get her, my husband and I, to elucidate further, like who this cricket was. But instead, I decided to write a few poems from the cricket's point of view. The spring cricket considers the question of negritude. I was playing my tunes all by myself. I didn't know anybody else who could play along. Sure, the tunes were sad, but sweet too, and wouldn't come until the day gave out. You know that way the sky has of dangling her last bright wisps? That's when the ache would bloom inside until I couldn't wait. I knelt down to scrape myself clean and didn't care who heard. Then came the shouts and whistles, the roundup into jars, a clamber of legs. Now there were others, tumbled, clouded. I didn't know their names. We were a musical lantern. Children slept to our rasping sighs. And if, now and then, one of us shook free and sang as he climbed to the brim, he would always fall again, which made them laugh and clap their hands. At least then we knew what pleased them and where the brink was. And one more spring cricket poem called Postlude. You prefer me invisible, no more than a crisp salute far away from your silks and firewood and woolens. Out of sight, I'm merely an annoyance, one slim, obstinate wrinkle in night's deepening trance. When sleep fails, you wish me shushed and back in my hole. As usual, you're not listening. Time stops only if you stop long enough to hear it passing. This is my business. I've got 10 weeks left to croon through. What you hear is a lifetime of song.
Wow.
I spend most of my nights working. That's when I come most alive. And so I'm such a night person that I usually don't go to bed until 6 a.m. It is not insomnia. It is my preferred way of being, but this poem is called Insomnia Etiquette. There's a movie on, so I watch it. The usual white people in love, distress, the usual tears. Good camera work though, sunshine waxing the freckled curves of a pear, a clenched jaw. More tragedy then. I get up for some scotch and Stilton. I don't turn on the lights. I like moving through the dark while the world sleeps on, serene as a stealth bomber nosing through clouds. Call it a preemptive strike, a precautionary measure so sadly necessary in these perilous times. I don't call it anything but greediness, the weird glee of finding my way without incident. I know tomorrow I will regret having the Stilton. I will regret not being able to find a book to get lost in, and all those years I could get lost in anything. Until then, it's just me and you, Brother Night, moonless, plunked down behind enemy lines with no maps, no matches, the woods deep. Cheers. And I will end this brief reading with the very first poem in the book. It was inspired by a student of mine who asked me why I never wrote prose poems. And so I said, okay, I will write a prose poem that's an anti-prose poem in a way. So with apologies to all of my friends who relish writing prose, I'm full of admiration for you, but this is one poet's take. Prose in a small space. It's supposed to be prose if it runs on and on, isn't it? All those words, too many to fall into rank and file, stumbling bare ass drunk onto the field, reporting for duty, yes, sir, spilling out shamelessly as the glut from a mega billion dollar chemical facility. Just the amount of glittering effluvium it takes to transport a little girl across a room, beige carpet thick under her Oxfords, curtains blousy with spring. Is that the scent of daffodils drifting in? Daffodils don't smell, but prose doesn't care. Prose likes to hear itself talk. Prose is development and denouement, anticipation hovering near the canopies, lust rampant in the antipastel. For example, a silver fork fingered sadly as the heroine crumbled a little linen napkin in her lap to keep from crying out at the sight of Lord Campion's regal brow inclined tenderly toward the wealthy young widow. Prose applauds such syntactical dalliances. Then is it poetry if it's confined? Trembling along its axis, a flagpole come alive in high wind, flapping its radiant sleeve for attention. Over here, it's me. While the white spaces, air, field, early morning silence before the school bell, shape themselves around that one bright seizure. And if that's so, what do we have here? A dream or three paragraphs? We have white space too. Is this music? As for all the words left out, banging at the gates, we could let them in, but where would we go with our orders, our stuttering pride?
I love that poem. I really do. I hear all of the different things you're trying to do in that poem. So thank you for just a beautiful reading. I'm really happy that you read the Nagi 14 Philadelphia, because later on I'm actually going to ask you about that poem. But first, I just want to thank you for this collection. It's been a couple of years, a little over a decade in terms of the poetry collection. So we are grateful to you that you have blessed us with this. I've read the book twice, and a number of the poems really stuck with me, and I'm going to ask you a few questions about some of them. But a number of years ago, you were quoted because you write in different genres. There's poetry, short story, novels, and you've done music, writing related to music. And in the Black American Literature Forum, you were quoted as there. You said, there's no reason to subscribe authors to particular genres. I'm a writer and I write in the form that most suits what I want to say. So with this collection, with this collection playlist for the apocalypse, what did you want to say? What were you trying to say in the form of poems if you chose to tell these stories?
Well, that's an interesting question. Because, part of what I was trying to say was also how to say it and how one lives with what has been said. So the very title, playlist, that emphasis on the playlist for the apocalypse is a way of saying these are poems that hopefully will accompany your moods, will augment them. You can live alongside them. That is certainly a result of what's been happening in this country, pandemic and pre-pandemic, and has been happening, I would venture to say, since the founding of this country. It's just now erupting in different places. The feeling of helplessness that we can have when we don't know exactly, how can we, a private citizen, possibly do anything? And also things that can accompany one person. terms of health, of aging. How does one, you know, live with that sense of mortality too? So all of those things are things that I'm trying to address in each poem. Some of them are in other personas. Some of them are in a voice that is, you know, a direct kind of speaking to the reader. But I really felt that they were not going to be poems that were going to be preaching at you, but they were, I would hope that the reader would sometimes say amen.
Yes, this reader said amen. And I'm saying that because you described it really well, because that's how I read the poems. There's so many subjects that you're writing about, but it does read like a playlist. It does read like it'll get you through these different ways and these different phases, whatever stage you're in. And there were some really heavy topics that are handled in ways that even in the way that you balance it, even the way that you told the story, you can digest it. The reader could digest it. So I read it much like a playlist. And now your work really does elegantly capture the extraordinary and the ordinary beautifully. So what I'm wondering about is this term public poet. People always refer to you as a public poet. And you often describe this way. And we know that you were in 93 to 95, the youngest and the first African-American US poet laureate. So what does it mean for you to be a public poet? And has this meaning changed, you know, from the earlier times of writing to now? What does that mean to be called a public poet? And how does that show up in your life?
Well, so it's amazing, actually, because I am a very shy person. And if someone had told me that I was going to be called a public poet, I probably would have passed out right there. Every poem that I write, I begin in silence and an intense intimacy, you know, with the work. I'm not thinking about the final product and how it's going to come over, because that can put all sorts of blockages on what one says. And so actually inside, I don't think of myself as a public poet at all, but I do hope that the poems in some way, you know, resonate with other people, that there is a invisible, I guess, tribe out there that we all belong to. In that sense, then I'm a public poet. Now, in practical terms, of course, it means that it means standing up in front of people and talking about poetry. And what it has meant for me is that sometimes I've heard too many voices. I've heard too many voices outside of me in order to, which got in the way of the writing. And it meant that I began to, especially with this volume, pull back and try to find periods of, or pockets, I could say, of solitude, so that I could eventually just be this one small dot, you know, talking to the universe. It's harder.
Yeah, as a writer, I understand that shyness. Often people think because you're standing in front of an audience and you're doing this and doing it so well, I mean, you read beautifully and your voice is beautiful. They don't think about that shyness factor. And this whole piece about being a public poet, I'm wondering if you've ever had to, and because there are so many, you know, in your poems, you write freely about Black lives, Black bodies, you write about women, you write about violence, and all these things balance with the beautiful, all the other experiences that you write about. And I'm wondering, do you police yourself in terms of this public image? And do you think about what you write about? Do you censor yourself at all? Have you done that throughout the course of your writing life as an artist?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And the act of writing, I try not to think of anyone else, not even myself. So I do not censor myself. The act of not showing something, of not publishing a poem or so, can happen later. I feel like I've told my students often this, that you can choose not to publish a poem. But if it is haunting you, you really can't choose not to write it. It's going to mess you up somewhere. The only kind of deliberate censorship that I've had, but not in the writing of the poem, in the, you know, giving it further, has it been if the poem in some way will hurt someone that I love or that, you know, does not deserve to be hurt, let's put it that way, then I won't publish it. I won't bring it out. And that's really the only thing. The only other time I've held poems back, I have worked on poems, and I talk about this a little bit in the notes to the back of Apocalypse playlist, that for the past, gosh, it's been like 20 years, I have been working through a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. I have MS. And the only reason why I did not make it public was because of my parents, who are unfortunately both, they're both passed on now, but they were struggling with their own health problems. And I thought they don't need this right now. I had figured, even when you hear the words MS, everyone thinks immediately of great horror stories. And I've been very lucky and managing mine. I've had some residual problems, but it's manageable. And I can't announce this until my parents, till they have passed on. And that's the only, those kinds of restrictions I've tried to do. But I feel like, Shapita, I feel like if the poet feels something and needs to write it, there are other people in the world who also feel the same thing. And it would be,
yes,
it's such a disservice in a way not to admit those secrets so that other people can say, oh, yes, I feel that way too.
Yes, and that's what it is. And you gave your students great advice with that. And, you know, it takes the courage too, because I think it was, you know, there are a number of writers that have talked about this courage it takes to speak up and speak out about these different issues. But I agree with you. I do think it's really important to tell your truth and to tell your story. And by the way, thank you for the notes in the book. I enjoyed reading those notes and learning about your work, your commission work with the Egypt series. All of these, they're the notes for the folks that are listening. Don't just read the poems, get to the notes. They read like poems themselves, all of them. So they were excellent. So I'm going to talk about a poem that you didn't read. It's called Youth Sunday. It's a poem about the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. But the way you wrote the poem about the four girls, and you focused on the interactions among the girls, their preoccupation, their fretting, their conversations. Unlike many of us poets, you deliberately did not talk about the bombing itself. I especially love the last line, "My, don't we look," what's the word the Reverend used in last Sunday's sermon? Oh, I got it. Ethereal. What a beautiful choice to end the poem that way. Can you tell us why you made that choice in the poem to focus on the girls and their interaction and not on the bombing itself because you've done that in other places too. I was just really interested. It was a lovely poem.
Oh, thank you so much. I that incident, like so many incidents, you know, they render us speechless. Because the evil behind it, the destruction and the grief is so deep that we cannot really, at least I cannot really talk about it. And yet, you don't want to forget that this has happened and to remember that behind the facts, which shout at us, right? Behind the facts are four girls whose lives were cut off. So for me to give them life again and to remind us this is who they are, they were, you know, they're just girls, right? That is in a way the best I could do, I guess you could say. You know, it's what I want to do, because in the face of that evil, I want to insist that we remember the humanity, the real humans. And that perhaps is the only way we can combat that feeling of helplessness. So when I wrote that poem, I know it had been, I had been asked to write a poem for the 1619 project, and of course was given an array of historical events to choose from. And it's a kind of odd thing to be given a list. Here's a list, you know, choose one of these. What I did, which is what I do with every poem, even in terms of its form, is I looked at these, this list, and waited for something to call to me. I waited for one of these incidents, be it, you know, a great migration or whatever, to call. And that just called to me. And when they called to me, these girls, I thought, oh my gosh, I can't do this. I just can't do this. But they kept calling. And that's another thing about a poem. You know, if it keeps haunting you, well, you gotta write it. So
yeah. And again, it was just really well done. And it was the beginning part of that, the Egypt series, where then you went on to a series of poems about Trayvon Martin and a number of other incidents. But I think in the notes, you expressed that the Egypt, this came out of more of a, I don't know if it was commissioned, but you went, can you tell us a little bit about that? Because the book is broken into several sections. And this particular section explores not only violence against black people, but you're also talking a lot about the word ghetto and these different, it could be in another section, but in different meanings of that. Can you tell a little bit about the project? Because it was interesting how the Youth Sunday kind of opened up into these other poems.
Yes, yes. Well, this project was, it was a wonderful idea, which was brought to me by Shaul Bassi. He is at the University of Venice in Italy. In preparation for the 500 year anniversary of the establishment of the ghetto in Venice, which was the first ghetto, the first one mentioned as a ghetto. The word ghetto comes from a Venetian dialect, which stands for slag, and that's because this particular quarter of Venice, where all the Jews were put in the year 1516, I think it was, this was the place where the foundry used to just dump all of its slag, so it gave them the worst land. And the project was to come to Venice for about a month and just experience the ghetto and to write something that dealt with reimagining the ghetto. So in other words, not only the Jewish ghetto, but all the permutations of this word, even the ghettos that we put up in our minds, you know, and the things that we assign ourselves. It was a wonderfully open-ended and expansive kind of project. I was given no guidelines, no one checked up on me. And so it's true that in this section, there are poems which begin in the Jewish ghetto in the 16th century and then move through concentration camps and then on to, unfortunately, what we have in this country today. And the Youth Sunday poem came as a kind of a, it's interesting because that was a different question that was asked of me by a different project organizer. And yet, because I suppose this whole ghettoized thinking and tragedy is all around us, it just fit right into the book. At the same time, there's something, and I think you said it was, it kind of blows things open in that section. So all those poems that are in that section, they all of them did not come out as a result of the Venice project of reimagining the ghetto, but they did send me on that path of thinking about the ways in which we have shuttered thinking, shuttered emotions, and of course the utter tragedies of racial inequity and violence.
Yes, very much so. And I wanted to ask you about just commission work in general. As an acclaimed poet and one who have earned everything you've worked for, and you often are asked to do commission work or special projects. And I'm just curious about that. What's your thought process behind that? Sometimes when I'm asked to do a commission work, it gets really, you know, like as you said, I think sometimes I sit with it and say, okay, I'm gonna let it come to me. I'm gonna figure this out because you wanna do justice by this. But sometimes it is fraught with a whole lot of other stuff. I just wanna know what your process is.
Oh, yes, it is. And you know, what's interesting is though there are several sections of poems in this book which got their origin in a commissioned project, I actually don't like commissioned projects very much at all. I agree with you. What happens is that you begin to think too much about it from the outside, you know, and so you think about the final project before you've gotten into it. And what I try to do with a commissioned project, anything commissioned, is if they ask, I have to see if I'm interested. I listen to think, oh, that sounds like, you know, I can do this. I want to do this. And only then will I go further. And then I usually don't accept it unless if I can already start writing, if I already start writing, then I'll say, you know, then maybe I can do it. What I do love, however, are collaborations with another artist from another genre, be it, you know, landscape architecture or composers, particularly since I'm so much into music. I really adore collaboration because the other artist stretches me too. There's a group of poems in here which are based on a collaboration with a composer, Richard Daniel Poor, a wonderful composer, and he had done an opera with Toni Morrison, and you know, Toni kind of gave him a stamp of approval, and I listened to his work, and he proposed this cycle of poems, which were going to be a song cycle. Because I'm a musician, I could hear it. He said, it's a mezzo soprano. I thought, oh yeah, that's perfect. And I thought, I can work with this man. And it was fantastic to work with him because he would push me, I would push him, you know, in terms of the thing. So anything that can put me back to school again and help me, you know.
Lovely. Yeah. So I'm going to do a little throwback question before my question that my last question is going to be a selfish question. As a writer, I really want to know about community, but I'm going to ask you, you had a quote from your Thomas and Beulah work, which are really, you know, about your grandparents, and you were asked, I think you said, I took liberties, but they would recognize themselves, meaning recognize themselves in the poem. So talk about writing about the familiar people and places. How do you approach it to ensure that you're doing it justice? You know, I love especially what you had to say about if you're writing something, you know, and especially if it's gonna hurt or harm someone, you'll still write and talk your piece, but you may not publish it. And today, a lot of us writers, you know, sometimes there's not that extra little pause button, you know? So I do wanna find, find out, how do you, talk to me about that, about this writing about familiar, especially people and places.
Well, you know, what's interesting was, especially with Thomas and Beulah, my mother helped a lot. She told me stories. I told her I was writing about her parents, and she trusted me. Now that trust, she didn't want to see any of the poems or anything like that, but that trust, and the fact that she also thought their story should be told. It's so often I will hear, relative or an older member of the community say, you really need to tell that one, you know, tell the story, don't be silenced. And so there is, on the one hand, the love of the community and the fact that people are saying, we want our stories told. That gives me a charge to do it. And also, though, the fact that they trust me, which means that I should do it right. And like you said, there is that pause button you have to hit. You have to sit there and say, is this going to hurt someone inadvertently? And I won't go past that. I change names. Change if there's someone who's directly referenced, I will change the name and the way they look and everything like that, because that's not the point. The point really is the story and what it tells us about ourselves. It's not a kind of, oh, look what so-and-so did. It's like, we all could do that too. And I think that that's really important to realize. Once you realize that the story is not about the person, but about that piece of humanity they're illuminating, it can also help you write about the familiar without harming anyone.
Yes, and I love how you spoke about changing your grandmother's name with Thomas and Beulah. I never knew that story. I believe your grandmother's name was Georgina, and yes, you changed it because I guess it just was long, I think you said.
Well, you know, yes, now I did not change my grandfather's name because Thomas and doubting Thomas, all of that was just so there. But Georgina, let's face it, it's a long word. And that's where the poet in me came in and said, we need a name that, you know, you need a name, I guess I should say, that doesn't just take over the page. Although my grandmother was someone who'd take over a room by walking into it.
I love that. So we're gonna open for questions soon. So my last little selfish artist question is this thing about community. When we got on this call right before the audience joined us, your warmth, your welcome, you don't know me from anything and we're just two writers. I felt so honored and just like, and you know, I just felt wonderful in your presence. How have you been able to cultivate, you mentioned Sister Toni Morrison, and the different writers, this feeling about community for us that are writing, you know, you're writing now, how did you cultivate that community? And is this something that still exists for you now?
This is such an important question, because the community is very difficult to cultivate. And that's, you discover, and I discovered as I began to publish and all of that, that I was always going somewhere and reading, but I would never see the friends, you know, that I had or be able to talk to other poets. And when we did talk, it was usually under the eyes of others, you know, so others were watching, ooh, look, there's, you know, Rita talking to somebody. And that, of course, is not a communication. I think that what has helped immensely, enormously, actually, is Facebook and the fact that now we do, I mean, I do a lot of, you know, private messages with my friend, with other friends and people, some people who might actually have not had an opportunity to meet. And yet I feel that they're really a close friend, you know, because we're sharing those kinds of things. You don't have to share them all on Facebook. You can also share them, you know, a little bit on a private message or even an email. So that has helped enormously. And I think that in the pandemic, this whole pandemic, which really took the last bit of in-person connection that we had away from us, that I've been looking, it seems like people have doubled down then in terms of the internet and said, okay, now we're going to really talk about things that before we didn't talk about. We're going to talk about them because this is the only way we have. So it's hard to maintain. It's very difficult to maintain. And I would tell everyone that is out there as a writer that if you, because usually it's about graduate school or schools, the last time you have that enforced communication because you're all together. If you have friends from there who are still writing, hang on to them and make sure that you hang on to each other.
Thank you for that. Thank you. Thank you for this great advice. And as we open up the questions, I want to thank you again. you know, long time ago, I think Alice Walker wrote about, was it Langston Hughes, and how she took some oranges to Langston Hughes when he was ill. And I always keep this in my mind about honoring our writers. And you had a quote about celebrities and all this other stuff. You're a celebrity. Our writers are celebrity. And I'm honored to have been in your presence today and to hear from you. You're someone I've read my entire poetry life. So I just want to tell you thank you. And thank you for this book. It's in the chat, everyone, the link to the book. And I need folks to just please click on it. It's a beautiful collection. And the notes in there will really, it'll inform you. Trust me on this one. So thank you, Sister Rita Dove. We're going to open for questions. And I didn't know if you had any comments before I open for questions. It's been an absolute pleasure.
The only comment I have is that it has been a real, real delight to be able to talk with you today and to meet you virtually. Someday it will be personally.
Yes, thank you. So I'm going to see the questions we have. I'm so proud of us. We are on time. So we have a question from Jacqueline Grisette, who said, you mentioned that you were referred to someone for a collaboration by Toni Morrison. Could you speak a little bit about your creative interaction or relationship in general with Toni Morrison? How did she influence your work or you hers, if at all?
Well, this is a very interesting question. First of all, let me just say that, make a little corrective to my own statement. It wasn't that I was collaborating with Toni Morrison, but that she had collaborated with the same composer that I had collaborated with. She and Richard Denner Poor had done an opera, Margaret Garner, together. And then he and I have put together this song cycle, A Standing Witness. But Toni Morrison, how can I? We were friends, yes. But we were friends also in that sense that we often didn't see each other and then would connect at one point or another. She was a beacon for me. I still remember going into the library and pulling out a book called The Bluest Eye and not having any idea what it was about, because libraries take off the covers. I didn't know who it was, but it called me again. It called me and I opened it up and I thought to myself, this book is going to save me. And it is from, at that point in my life, I think I was in graduate school. I kept thinking, where are the stories about African Americans from the Midwest? I come from Ohio and everything I read was either New York or, you know, the South. And I said, but we have a voice too. And there she was. So, you know, I read every single one of her books. She helped me. I can't even explain how deeply she moved me in terms of being a writer, in terms of also just being able to believe that the stories of people in the Midwest, Black people in the Midwest, mattered. And that's a huge thing. So she has, and she continues to influence me.
Wow, thank you. Yes, she left her mark on so many, many people and continue to this day. And then you have Deborah Copps has a question for you. Do you show your poems to a few fellow poets before pursuing publication?
Yes, it's a very good question, Deborah, and people do it in different ways. I tend to show my poems to my husband, who is a writer. He's a German novelist. He's not a poet. And we have this pact that we read each other's work, but only when the other person gives it to you. You know, no sneaking around looking on other people's desks. And the other thing is that after we get the critique, you have to allow 24 hours before you protest, you know, or try to argue. In other words, let that stuff sit. So I will tend to show him my work at some point. The best thing, I don't show my work to other poets. I don't have a group of poets to show my work to. I wish I, you know, did, but I don't. And so time is the thing that helps with me. I will let a poem sit, and I'll let it sit, even if I think it's done for, you know, weeks, sometimes months, to make sure that it's still singing.
Yeah. I love that. Make sure it's still singing. Wonderful. So Marie just has a comment. She says, thank you. You are a luminous presence and poet. So thank you, Maria. That was really kind. And from Richard Townsend, he said, a return of the bunny suicides. I don't mean to bring down a level of conversation, but please tell us more.
Richard is referring to a column in the New York Times Book Review by the book, where I was asked what books were on my shelves that people might be surprised by. And one of them is The Return of the Bunny Suicides. It's a captioned book, a cartoon book of bunnies. Each one, the bunny has devised a very different way of committing suicide. It is very, it's a German word for it. It's a crooked kind of humor. I mean, it's odd, and it's weird, and it's outrageous. And for some reason, if I'm feeling stressed, looking at this cartoon book kind of brings me up because I think it's so ridiculous.
So Richard, you have your answer. from Yolanda Wisher, who is a Philadelphia icon and also a former a Philadelphia poet laureate, who, by the way, loves your poem Canary by Billie Holiday. All right, so Yolanda has a question for you. What songs are in your musical playlist these days? Speaking of playlists.
Wow, that's an amazing one. You know, what's interesting is that recently I have been very silent. Usually I have music all the time. And recently I have not been playing very much music. I do tend to love blues. And so I've been playing a lot of Samantha Fish and, Etta James. I sometimes say just play me some blues. I'll say to little Alexa, and she will just do it. So because I think it's the randomness I need right now. I need the random sense of, I don't know what's coming next, but it's all in that same slot. You know, it's all the blues. So that's what I've been doing.
Love Etta James. Wow, I feel like we have been on this back porch and we've just been talking and doing all our things here. I want to know, and first of all, I'm so glad that you are doing well. And I know you talked about your diagnoses. I'm really happy that you're doing well. And I want to know, what were the things that you were doing during this pandemic period that you want to continue beyond? There were some habits we all got into, and we had to do certain things, these Zoom calls and all this other stuff. So what are some things that you got into that you're just going to have to continue doing, and something that you don't want to continue doing?
Oh, that's what a great question. I haven't even thought about it, because one of the things that I have, in fact, enjoyed in the pandemic is the fact that I couldn't go anywhere, and therefore I couldn't travel, and I could actually sit at my desk and write. At my desk and not, you know, some hotel desk or something like that. One writes, I think, wherever you can. But that quiet, enforced though it may be, that quiet was a blessing and helped me, in fact, hear my way through this book, the final stages of this book. So I wish that I could continue some sense of that kind of solitude when I'm getting ready to write. I mean, the internet and everything it entails is wonderful on the one hand, but the other thing is that everyone expects you to be there all the time. And we all know this, and it takes up our lives. And I found some odd pockets of time because of the pandemic. I'd love to continue that. I would, I certainly don't want to do Zooms anymore. I'm so tired of ring lights and getting the right setting. And as we were trying to do today, I can't see anybody. I love to be with people when we're talking about poetry. I couldn't wait to drop that. I wish I could continue doing jigsaw puzzles because I have been doing them every once in a while. They calm me in an amazing way. I don't know why. I can get lost in them. And I wish I could. I don't think I'll have time, though.
Yeah, I don't know that we need to know why we get lost in the jigsaw puzzles. You just do them, right? Yeah, I love the idea of just little walks and lounging and not have to go anywhere. I'm very much one of those. If I don't have to go anywhere, I don't need to go anywhere. Yeah. So you know, you have a question about someone says getting published for a new writer still seems like such a black box. What advice would you give for those looking for a publisher for the first work or an agent or anything like that? That question comes up a lot.
Well, this is a very difficult, a different thing, I think, in this day and age. And I'm not sure if the question is just about getting published or getting a book published. Because if you're going to get a book published, then of course you have to have, for poetry, you should have poems published. And the first advice I'd give you in those stages is that to look at the magazine online or otherwise, read it and see if this is a place that you could imagine your poems being put. Just to go out and say, oh, I'm just going to send it to so-and-so because it's a big magazine, but not having looked at what they do and what they like, is disrespecting, actually, the place that you're sending. So that's the first thing. And also the second thing is, rejections are going to happen. And they've happened to all of us. And, I think every poem in my second book was rejected at once, at least. You just keep going. You just keep going. Now, in terms of finding a publisher or an agent of publishers, it's really the same kind of thing. You see who they have published and if they would like your work. And then you send out the query. My agents, I can't really help you with because I don't have an agent. And I never have. I had one briefly when I had my novel out. That was. And it's everybody's call. Nowadays, it seems like everyone has an agent, so.
Yeah, so wonderful. So I'm reminding everyone to please make sure in the chat, please go to the chat and you will see that the books with signed book plates are available at Joseph Fox Bookshop. And the link is there. Do it, click on it. You're gonna love these poems. And and I told this to Rita, I said, it's been a little while. So we're really happy to see these poems. So again, I want to thank you all. We're at the hour and we have spent this lovely hour together. I want to thank Sister Rita Dove for this marvelous, marvelous moment. And I don't know if you have any last comments or anything before we close our evening.
Well, first of all, thank you, Tokita, for such a wonderful conversation. And I want to thank everyone who came for your comments and just for your energy, which I can feel. So that's really great. I don't really have a closing comment except to say that Shelley once said that the poets are the legislatures of the race, and to remember that as we go forward.
Thank you. Everyone have a lovely, safe evening. Take care of yourselves. Be good to yourselves and put some positive energy out there. And thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for offering this opportunity and for us to share great poetry, meet wonderful artists, and for me to meet one of the icons and people I really respect in the poetry world. So thank you all. Have a lovely, lovely evening. And Sister Rita Dove, hopefully soon in flesh and in person, we'll see each other.
I hope so.
All right. Have a lovely evening, all.
Have a great
Bye-bye.
Evening.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.